Well, welcome back. If we could ask everyone to find a seat and close the doors. We have with us today Lee Dexter, who operates White Egret Farm just on the edge of Austin, Texas. Her cheeses and goat's milk are known and favorites in our area. But before she was running a dairy, she was a scientist. She's got holds a master's degree in biology. And when the government came after her for raw milk issues and others, she fired right back on constitutional grounds and mostly using sound science. Tomorrow night she'll tell an amazing tale about their journey through the court system, but tonight she's going to bring you up to speed on the truth, the real science behind raw milk, some topics she just touched on in the panel discussion yesterday. So we're thrilled to have with us Lee Dexter.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to bring you a compilation of what Keith Tindall and I have gathered together over the last 3 or 4 years. Much of what we have gathered together was in response to a 3.5 year battle with the Texas Department of Health. And they came at us with no holds barred, trying to shut us down, and thought that we would roll over very easily and just dry up and blow away. What we found was that the science they were using was about 20 years out of date, and that many of the bureaucrats in that particular agency were retirees from other places, from the military and other places, and only were educated at the level of buzzwords. So in front of judges, we were able to bring in some real peer-reviewed science and defend raw milk based on real evidence and not just on someone's opinion. I apologize for our slides today. We had some laptop incompatibility, and you're going to find that some of the visuals have a little bit of distortion, but I hope that doesn't bother us too much as we go through this talk. What we're really going to talk about today is that Mother Nature, or God, however you would like to think about it, is really a lot smarter than we are. And we're going to talk about what Mother Nature intended with raw milk and what we have done to wreck that in our commercialized system. When you're working with your customers or consumers who want to buy raw milk from you, we really have three levels of protection. And this is what I talk about with our customers. What Mother Nature intended. Then we may have testing at the state level by whatever regulatory agency you're dealing with. And finally, and really importantly, we have what the farmer, what the dairy farmer himself is doing to protect the integrity of that milk and work with Mother Nature instead of against her. The University of Southern California has finally recognized and has some activists on their department. One of them is a professor named German who reminds us that milk was the only food created by God or by nature to protect and nurture the newborn, to assure that we had tissue maturation in the young. And he points out that there is no other food that has been designed to protect mammals. He points out that plants really don't like us. They have a lot of defense mechanism, thorns and toxins and stickers to prevent us from eating all plants easily. But milk is the only food that has come right along with us from the beginning. Consider this. I'm assuming that all of you have witnessed births, and births are rather messy things. Babies are born in a pool of wet, warm muck on the ground, in contact with soil and the herd's manure. Baby gets up and starts to nurse on tits that have been in contact with manure and soil. And if we listen to our health officials, they would say that that's an ideal place for pathogenic or harmful bacteria to grow. If that was true, why aren't we all dead? That's the question. Why have mammals survived and survived very well on this planet? The answer lies with what is inside the milk. We had one grade school student ask one of the most interesting questions when she was looking at our website. She asked us why milk was white. And I don't think I've ever had such a good question from an adult, but we really need to think of milk not just as a liquid that contains carbohydrates and proteins and fats, but it is really a biochemical soup. And it is white because in crystalline or dried form, those biochemicals are white. What we did to defend ourselves and what I encourage all of you to do is to begin to know the science behind raw milk. What is the evidence for its efficacy or what is the evidence for its harm? In Austin in the mid-80s, raw milk was legal to be sold in stores. And then the American Medical Association came into Austin and said, my God, everybody's going to be dead. You've got to get rid of this raw milk. And so the city council was very threatened, and they solicited, quote unquote, opinions from various people. And if you look at the data submitted by scientists who gave those opinions, they are only opinions. They gave no data whatsoever. And the Department of Health made their decision based on people's opinions. And that's what we want to get away from. The way Mother Nature would have it, if you have a clean milk supply, harmful organisms are going to be kept in check by some very active components. The bioactive components are the same no matter whether we're talking about humans, whether we're talking about rats, or whether we're talking about horses. They may differ in their quantity and their potency, but they're the same across all mammals. And these we call bioactive ingredients with a mission. Most of them have dual purposes. Most of them keep harmful bacteria in check, and they stimulate and strengthen the immune system of the human who is drinking the milk. One of my favorite systems within raw milk is the lactoperoxidase system. This is an enzyme system in bovine milk or cow milk. It is the second most concentrated enzyme and accounts for about 0.5% of whey proteins. Lactoperoxidase uses small amounts of hydrogen peroxide and a free radical to seek out and destroy bad bacteria. And it is one of the main reasons why those babies born in that wet, warm muck stay healthy and alive when they get up to suckle on mother. There are also other interesting proteins. One of the most famous is lactoferrin. Lactoferrin has several jobs. It steals iron away from harmful bacteria in the gut, and it carries it through the intestinal wall into the bloodstream. And we're going to talk about two-dimensional versus three-dimensional thinking in a minute, but those binder proteins are destroyed by pasteurization. There's another one that is a binder protein for folic acid. And like vitamin D that we heard about in a previous speaker, folic acid, which is a B vitamin, has been associated with a reduction in cancer and heart disease of all types. Lactoperoxidase is in all mammalian secretions. It's in breast milk, it's in tears, it's in urine. And one interesting aspect of this system is that it is being considered by other countries in lieu of pasteurization. Countries like Spain recognize that when you heat milk above 160 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to destroy these bioactive proteins. And so they're looking at enhancing the lactoperoxidase system to use it instead of pasteurization and instead of irradiation. In Spain today, goat milk consumption, for instance, is increasing, and people are drinking raw goat milk with bacteria counts of 6.4 million. What the Spanish want to do is, in remote areas up in the mountains where pasteurization may not even be practical, they want to stimulate this system so that their country's artisan cheesemaking craft can be done with better quality milk. The lactoperoxidase system actually uses thiocyanate, tiny amounts of thiocyanate, to seek out and destroy harmful bacteria. And you'll notice that thiocyanate, which is abbreviated SCN there, is also found in human serum, in bovine serum, in tears, and in urine. It's one of the things that keeps your eyes from being infected also. Researchers can take advantage of this system, and they have actually challenged raw milk with harmful bacteria. One of the most common foodborne pathogens is a bacterial species called Campylobacter. Campylobacter causes digestive upsets. It's relatively self-limiting. And what researchers do is that they inject these harmful bacteria into raw milk, and they then test the milk 12 and 24 and 48 hours later to see if bacteria like Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter are still living. These studies happen to have been done with goat milk, and we were dealing with goat milk, but the same thing can be said of cow milk. In 1985 already, a public health researcher in the UK found that raw goat milk would not support the growth of Campylobacter. It killed it dead. There wasn't any. Furthermore, she looked at nearly 2,500 samples of raw goat milk in the UK and presented data not only on raw milk but on frozen raw milk, which is very interesting because there are very few studies on frozen raw milk. And she found no salmonella whatsoever, no matter whether the milk was produced in the south of England near London or in Wales out in the mountainous wild. So what we can use for evidence about the safety of raw milk are these challenge studies, where raw milk has actually been challenged by injections with Shigella, Salmonella, and these other organisms that cause digestive upsets. This is one aspect that the Texas Department of Health just couldn't get over. They thought we were really going to roll over. I ended up having to give 10 hours of deposition on this type of thing, and we landed 2,500 pages of peer-reviewed literature at the Attorney General's office, not in order, I might add, and made them go through it. And they were just dumbfounded. They just didn't even know what questions to ask when we got to these challenge studies. The public health authority in the UK concluded that any problems with goat's milk relate to poor hygiene during production rather than transmission of the organisms by the goat herself. So these studies are out there, and they've been out there for a long time. This study could have stopped the whole reversal of raw milk sales in Austin, Texas, had somebody bothered to look it up in the mid-80s. Another really interesting component of raw milk are fatty acids. If any of you have ever dealt with essential oils and have kept them in plastic jars, you'll notice that the essential oils will eat the plastic after a time. And the same thing is happening in raw milk with fatty acids. They are highly antibacterial and antifungal. In the case of goat milk, they are so antibacterial that the test for the presence of antibiotics in goat milk had to be changed because the goat milk kept killing the test bacteria. Literally true. So the National Mastitis Council has now changed the official test for the presence of antibiotics in goat milk because the goat milk kept giving false positives. Two fatty acids stick out here. We talked about candida in the last session. Those are caprylic and caproic fatty acids. They are highly antifungal, and they do it by eating the cell wall of the bacteria and the fungi. And then the bacteria and the fungi cannot reproduce in the gut. Those two fatty acids are also responsible for off flavors and off odors in milk because when they oxidize, they give you that quote-unquote goaty smell. So that's where the farmer comes in really taking care of raw milk and keeping it very cold so you get as little oxidation as possible. Enzymes do the same thing. Most consumers who are beginning to take care of their health understand that there are enzymes in raw milk. And that's one of the biggest reasons that they give you that they're going to get live enzymes if they drink raw milk. That's true. The enzymes will even be preserved under freezing and will continue to work even under frozen conditions. And that's why frozen raw milk will only last just so long, because eventually the enzymes will break, quote unquote, the emulsion, and you'll get a white layer on top and a liquid layer on the bottom. Polysaccharides, this is another one of my favorite topics. Those are long, sugary, soluble fiber type molecules. They encourage the growth of good bacteria and they line the gut. It's like lining the gut with a mucus layer, and they help to prevent leaky gut syndrome. And almost all Americans have leaky gut syndrome to one extent or another. And what we mean by that is that their colon is literally porous. And bacteria from the colon leak out into the bloodstream, causing an immune system red alert. And when the immune system is overworked, then we get into all these other susceptibilities that we were talking about during the last couple of sessions. And so what we want is colons that are sealed up. We want those bacteria to stay in the colon. And it isn't so much that raw milk, quote unquote, cures anything, but rather it sets up physical barriers that allow the body to cure itself. And that's what we're really after. It allows the immune system to relax. And Keith and I have often said that we're going to put a baby gallery up on our website, because babies drinking raw cow milk can be picked out of a lineup. Fathers can see this right away. When the immune system relaxes, babies can take that extra energy and they can put it into growth. And I'm old enough to have remembered baby Huey from the cartoons on TV during the 50s. It was an enormous baby that waddled around, and we kid our customers that their babies will end up looking like baby Huey. They'll be very robust, and they are, and you can tell their skin is better. They're more robust. They're not getting colds. They're not getting ear infections. They don't have eczema. They don't spit up all the time. And they don't stink. It's very obvious. It's very visible. Some of the other things in raw milk that help the immune system relax are antibodies. They bind to foreign microbes. They help to prevent them from migrating outside the gut. They grab them like Pac-Man and hold on to them. So they let the immune system take care of them in the gut instead of out in the bloodstream. Dr. Winter mentioned yesterday that there are enough white blood cells in raw milk to seek out and destroy harmful bacteria as well. And there are white blood cells, beta lymphocytes, macrophages, which are the Pac-Man kind of things, neutrophils, T lymphocytes, the killer T cells. And when those guys are working in the gut, the immune system doesn't have to work so hard. Those work in conjunction, again, with the medium-chain fatty acids we talked about, with lactoferrin, with lysozyme, which is a fat-eating enzyme, and with growth factors that help promote the growth of the cells in the colon. Are you beginning to see that a really working gut has redundant systems? This is what, if you want to think about God or Mother Nature, a lot of these systems are doing the same thing. One system is stealing minerals away from pathogenic bacteria. Another one is eating up their cell walls. Mucins and oligosaccharides, which are sticky long molecules, are preventing these gut from sticking to the colon wall and reproducing. So Mother Nature has these redundant systems in raw milk that protect the body from bacteria reproducing, from bacteria attaching, and from bacteria leaking out into the bloodstream. I want to talk a minute about binder proteins. This is something almost no one knows anything about. But Mother Nature is not stupid. And you really, really get a feel for that when you start talking about binder proteins. I don't expect you to look at these numbers. I just put this table up here, which is a typical nutrient content comparison. Notice that it's just long columns of the nutrient and how much there is. And I guess you got to start someplace. But this is the typical two-dimensional thinking of our current medical profession. And goat milk, for instance, is known for being lower in folic acid than cow milk. And so for years, physicians said, oh my God, you know, you can't feed children goat milk because they won't get enough folic acid. But Mother Nature doesn't work two-dimensionally. Mother Nature works three-dimensionally. She's already thought about that problem. And there's a special binder protein that was discovered 25 years ago that takes this little bit of folic acid, that 0.7 micrograms of folic acid, and carries it right through the intestinal wall into the bloodstream. So even though you had just a little bit there to begin with, babies come out just fine. They have for thousands of years. Finally, in the year 2000, a scientist published a story using baby pigs as models, and they found out that you don't have to supplement raw milk with anything, neither folic acid nor iron, because we have binder proteins for the different vitamins and the different minerals. And those binder proteins are one of the things that is destroyed during pasteurization because they're three-dimensional. We're going to talk about pasteurization and what it does here in just a minute. But happily, what we're beginning to see is that if we get children away from some of these denatured proteins, we can defend them against juvenile diabetes, asthma, allergies, and other disorders that are based on the immune system. Here's what happens when we pasteurize these bioactive components. You've all had a set of Tinker Toys at some time in your life, right? Proteins are built just like Tinker Toys. They're big three-dimensional things, and they have all kinds of branches that stick up. And the body has all kinds of receptive molecules to work with those three-dimensional proteins. When you pasteurize proteins, that is when you heat them above 160 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm not going to slam this table because my computer's on it, but it's just like taking that protein and squishing it. And now you have a hard glob. You've got a ball. Think about a raw egg. Hens put antibodies in the yolks, just like cattle put antibodies into raw milk. And if you take that egg, which is fluid and gushy and easy to spread around, and you put that egg in a hot frying pan, all of a sudden you've got a hard white albumin that you now have to cut with a fork, and you've got a yolk that is yellow and powdery. You've got to cut it with a fork. And the bioactivity of those proteins is then gone. So one of the things that we can talk about with our customers is that we are providing superior nutrition because we're not taking what Mother Nature gave to us and wrecking it with high heat. And the Europeans are way ahead of us on this. They're already thinking about that. That's why they're thinking about the lactoperoxidase system, because they know that these high heat treatments really ruin those proteins. And unfortunately, FDA's thinking is, well, pasteurization these days doesn't kill all thermophilic or heat-loving organisms. We better ultra-pasteurize, okay, which is going exactly the other way. So when the body sees one of these denatured proteins, its enzymes can't fit on it anymore like a lock and key structure like it's supposed to do. So it says, my God, what is this glump? We've got a foreign invader. An alien has landed from Mars. We better get rid of it. And so the immune system begins to mount an expedition against that denatured protein. And that's what we see in a lot of our babies. Our goats have been in continual production since 1973. I cannot tell you how many babies we've had where their faces are just covered with eczema, where they have constant ear infections, constant colds, constant gastric disorder. They stink, they don't sleep through the night because their immune system is completely stressed out. And I don't expect you to look at this either, but this chart lists some of the things that we talked about that are in raw milk. And look at the right, the two columns on the right, if you will. By the time we get done with pasteurization in what I call retail cow milk, that is commercial pasteurized cow milk, what we're left with are the fatty acids, which are heat stable. We're left with the oligosaccharides, which are heat stable, and we're left with some of the growth hormones. In infant formula, we're not even left with some of those because it's treated at a much higher temperature and then insulted by being dried. So we're really feeding our children foods right from the get-go that are going to set them up later in life for asthma, allergies, all these immune-related symptoms. And that's why those symptoms are increasing in our society. I have a few quick tables here of what's inactivated by pasteurization, all the things that we talked about, the white blood cells, the binding proteins, the lactoperoxidase system. And by the way, if the lactoperoxidase system is left to its own accord, it is strongest at days 3 and 4, right when your customer or your consumer is going to drink that raw milk from his or her refrigerator. So that's one of the systems that we really want to look for. You've all heard of interferon, a natural cytokine in the body that helps the immune system work. The enzymes are inactivated. and the bifidus factor, which is a vitamin-like thing to help the bifidobacterium grow, is also inactivated. Look what happens to the minerals. By the way, every AIDS patient on the planet has a low selenium level. Selenium is one of those minerals that you've got to have to run your immune system. Pasteurization decreases it almost 10%. It decreases iron by 66%. It decreases zinc, another mineral that you need to run your immune system, by almost 70%. What does it leave? Sodium and potassium. Okay? It decreases the availability of calcium. And so all the vitamin C goes down 77%, E goes down 15%. And vitamin D, which we just heard about in the last lecture, is completely destroyed. And that's why pasteurized milk processors have to add not real vitamin D with all its cofactors, but synthetic vitamin D back into the milk. In typical pasteurization, in a Borden's plant near us, the temperatures that they reach are 178 degrees for 15 seconds. And then I'm just giving you a couple of the references here. For interestingly, the Spanish are the ones who are really out in front with this mineral business about the effect of pasteurization on mineral availability in milk. Remember that modern pasteurization was not developed for nutrition, but rather for distribution. And we touched on that yesterday. What was happening when pasteurization was developed is that babies were dying, and particularly in New York City and New Jersey in the early 1900s, like 1903 to 1910, because there was all kinds of problems with milk sanitation in those days. And there was a big controversy between farmers in New Jersey who wanted to go the certified raw milk route and farmers in New York and New York City who wanted to do pasteurization so they didn't have to get rid of their tuberculin-laden cattle. But because we have adopted this system, it's really robbing consumers of the nutrients that they need to stay healthy. Raw milk has, as we just described, has its own immune system. And if you get in the way of that, you open yourself up for foodborne illnesses. And the Attorney General's office in Texas was trying to trip me up. They always tell me, now, Miss Dexter, you know that milk is an ideal medium for growing bacteria. Isn't that right? And the answer to that is no, it's not. As the matter of fact, I did the arithmetic from the Center for Disease Control Statistics. And people drinking raw cow milk have a 2.5 to 3.5 times lower incident rate from foodborne diseases of all kinds than people drinking pasteurized cow milk. So the proponents of pasteurization need to go back and look at the arithmetic. 1.9 cases per 100,000 people drinking raw milk and 4.7 cases per 100,000 people drinking pasteurized milk. And yet raw milk gets blamed for it. There is a food scientist at the University of Georgia who proved that salmonella can survive on coins. So when you're passing quarters and pennies and dimes back and forth, or children are putting them in their mouth, these people may be getting ill just from paying for raw milk. And when we look at foodborne illnesses, the vast majority of cases have occurred in pasteurized milk. The biggest single foodborne outbreak in the U.S. was in 1994. You all probably remember this, when 3.4 million people ate some of the 1 million gallons of ice cream shipped from a Schwann's plant right here in Marshall, Minnesota, because they didn't have all their piping properly cleaned, and Salmonella enteritidis got into that pasteurized milk. There wasn't any stopping it, and it just went to town. 224,000 people became ill. And the literature is full of that. You can find it. It's out there. I guess I'm saying this with such vehemence because if you are challenged by a regulator, need to contact us to get you some of this information. Otherwise, you'll get run over by bureaucrats who are trying to tell you that raw milk is an ideal medium for harmful bacteria. And again, the answer to that is no. So Mother Nature has really made a pretty perfect system for protecting us from harmful bacteria, from protecting that calf who's born in a manure pile in the middle of the rain, to keep that calf alive, to keep us alive. And what's interesting is that the lactoperoxidase system in cow and goat milk is higher even than it is in breast milk. And if you think about it, it's probably because humans have always picked their babies up, whereas cattle and goats tend to be down on the ground, so they need more potent protection. But when you deal with your customers, you've got a couple other more mundane levels. You've got state inspections, and you've got your own sanitation program. Are you in a position to provide test results to customers? Is it necessary? I actually try to avoid it because then they'll whine and they'll say, well, you had 20,000 bacteria per milliliter last month, and this month it's 25. You know, why? The ultimate test to the consumer is how long did their milk last and how good is it? How good did it taste? But longitudinal data, if you collect your own data or you keep your state's reports back to you, is a very, very potent selling tool when you're selling to consumers. Freshness is also a key to bioactivity. Typically, with raw milk sales, we're selling milk that's less than 48 hours old. Okay? Milk on the grocery store shelves, you all probably have now taken this for granted, can be up to 3 weeks old. And those puffy cartons, don't buy those. I've gotten so that I could pick them out, and one of the things that we did to defend ourselves was we went to 7-Elevens and convenience stores, notorious places for refrigerators that are too warm, and we bought those puffy cartons. And we sent that milk to a lab to have it analyzed. And instead of the 20,000 bacteria per milliliter we're supposed to have coming out of a pasteurization plant, those cartons had 3.2 million bacteria. And I'm kind of a rabble rouser. And so I told the state's attorney general, now don't you tell me that the number of bacteria is a good marker for how safe that milk is. And I've flopped those numbers in front of them. Most scientists actually believe that the number of bacteria is not a good marker, and rather that some lipopolysaccharides from harmful bacteria are better markers. But this is another selling tool, and this is another reason that milk directly from the farm with its lactoperoxidase system intact is a safer bet than milk that you're going to pick up from the 7-Eleven that's been there for 3 weeks. Know your specifications. These are some that we have to follow in Texas. Our raw milk law requires that we turn out raw milk with the same bacterial count as milk coming out of a pasteurization plant. And raw milk going into a pasteurization plant may by law have five times this amount of bacteria. Furthermore, you're in a better position as individual farmers to keep drug residues and pesticides out of your milk. The GAO reports that 30% of commercial milk samples contain measurable levels of contaminants like antibiotic residues or pesticides. And if you're a smart farmer, you know that the state's only looking for four different antibiotics and you're going to use another one. In Texas, 30% of the farms tested, 30% of the dairy farms have been suspended during the year for either antibiotic residues, pesticides, or water contamination. Now, you all know how that PMO system works. If you're suspended, it means you've had three violations on the same thing. So it means that at least three times during the year, your milk was contaminated. You're also in a better position. Some doctors believe that xanthine oxidase is the only proven physical cause of heart disease. And what happens during the homogenization process is that the homogenization process encapsulates this particular enzyme called xanthine oxidase in little tiny balls, tiny enough to get through the intestinal wall into the bloodstream, where it begins to chew on the heart muscle. And what some researchers have shown is that this enzyme is directly responsible for some of these people, like runners, who are pumping heart or pumping blood through their heart really fast, and they're 47 years old, and they drop dead on the track of a heart attack. So homogenization is not the innocent process that it appears. In defending yourself, one of the things that you need to know, one definition that you need to know, is what is adulteration? You'll hear from bureaucrats all the time, this food is adulterated. And they'll use that word whether they mean mislabeled, whether they mean it contains a toxicant or not. In order to be adulterated, milk has to contain a poisonous or deleterious substance which may render it injurious to health. But in the case the substance is not an added substance, the food shall not be considered adulterated under blah, 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 if the quantity of the substance in the food does not ordinarily render it injurious to health. And where this rubber hits the road is particularly with Staph aureus. Almost anybody that milks cows has got Staph aureus in their raw milk. Okay? Is it a problem? Probably not. FDA has guidelines about how many organisms you have to have before Staph aureus becomes a problem. And most state regulations don't take that into consideration. They've got limits that are way lower than the federal guideline. And so it pays to know what the definition of adulteration is and what the limits on Staph aureus are. I think I have another. One researcher in Eastern Europe found that Staph aureus being consumed at 500 colony-forming units per milliliter was no menace to healthy infants. Now, can I get back? Okay. It pays to know what a pathogen is. Because the other thing you're going to get thrown at you, and well, the one of the things that we got thrown at us a lot was, well, this paper talked about an 80-year-old woman with no colon, and she drank raw milk, and this is what happened to her. That doesn't count. There are like hundreds of those things, hundreds of case reports in the literature. But a pathogen has a very specific definition. A pathogen has to cross a barrier in an otherwise healthy person. So you could have a completely harmless organism fall into somebody's gashing wound, cause an infection, and it is not a pathogen because it didn't cross a barrier in a healthy person. A pathogen has to be virulent enough that it crosses a barrier. The FDA at the national level understands this, and that's why they have set different limits of the numbers of organisms that you can have in a food before it is considered injurious. And in order to sort all this out, you really need experts, and the word is qualified by training and experience, to sort out these single case reports from somebody getting sick on raw milk versus somebody getting sick on tomatoes. One of the things that we talked about a lot is that raw milk is not getting equal protection under the law, because there are all kinds of other foods, eggs being a big culprit, that have much greater instances of foodborne illness associated with them than raw milk. So that's another level of defense. On the farmer level, the lactoperoxidase system can be overwhelmed. And it gets overwhelmed when you get to about 10 million bacteria per milliliter. And that's why there was so much problem in New York City and New Jersey in the early part of the 1900s, because they weren't using hot water, they didn't have good detergents, they didn't have stainless steel, they had all kinds of sanitary problems, and they can overwhelm the system. And so that's why in the beginning of the talk we said, if you have milk that is good and clean and has a good shelf life, this system will work with you. If your milk has too high a bacteria content, the bacteria will just chew up this enzyme and you won't get its benefit. We have our mouth on pathogens every single day. That's why I say raw milk is not getting equal protection under the law. Breast milk has pathogens, and washing nipples with a surgical scrub doesn't prevent it. Donated milk to milk banks. Almost 22% of donated milk failed to meet the British Physicians Association's guidelines. Tomatoes, salad bars, egg salad, French ice cream. There are all kinds of other foods that contain pathogens. But our bureaucrats don't think about that. And what these kinds of numbers argue for is it's the terrain, it's not the bug. Okay? Because we're coming in contact with pathogens every day. So our position is that people need to be responsible for their own health. One evidence that you can give to doctors and to consumers is your own test results. Our farm has been publicized in a book that hit the New York Times bestseller list called The Maker's Diet. And it only took about 60 days for that thing to be out before FDA landed at our farm and did a full 6-day inspection. They took statistically based samples of of milk. They took 12 milk samples. They took 12 yogurt samples. They are going to send it to their lab. Do you think for 1 minute that I didn't send our samples to a different lab? So one other way to protect yourself is to have your own samples. If FDA samples are going to a lab in Denver, we took quote-unquote aliquots, which means subsets of the same sample, and we sent it here to Medallion in Minneapolis. And they provided us results so that if there is any funny business, you'd be in a better position to counteract that. Let's talk about cheeses for my last 2 or 3 minutes. Ma'am?
I just had a question about the previous slide. When you test for those kind of pathogens, are those the ones you choose?
Yeah, there's a set screen. We're going to look at Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, Yersinia, and coagulase positive Staphylococcus. Now, not all, these are genus names. So for instance, the Listeria that you worry about is Listeria monocytogenes. It's not another Listeria that may not be pathogenic. Okay? We actually believe that a lot of our problems stem from the fact that the Manufactured Foods Division in Texas took over regulation of cheeses from milk and dairy in the mid to late 90s. Unfortunately, they didn't know anything about cheese. And they started sampling our cheeses and finding that they were really high in bacteria. One regulator told me that our cheeses had more bacteria than a sewage plant. And I, of course, being the gentle soul that I am, said, well, I hope so. And that really did not sit well with them. But they kept sampling our cheeses, finding them really high in bacteria. They condemned them. And then we never got our cheese or our money back. And it turns out, in the end, I finally got my head out of a certain part of my anatomy. And I figured out that they were using the milk standard for cheese. And cheese is a cultured food. It's supposed to have tons of bacteria. Raw milk cheeses are supposed to have tons of bacteria. So I wanted to spend the last 2 minutes talking about traditional food processing with raw milk cheeses. Here's the lesson. There's always a reason why it works. Okay? So if people in Greece have been doing marinated cheeses in olive oil, garlic, and basil for several thousand years and they aren't dead yet, okay, there's a reason why that process works. Unfortunately, our health departments have not caught up with this. So we had what I call the Great White Egret Farm Marinated Cheese Fight. And they were going to make me go to Texas A&M and get a, what do they call that thing? A process authority. And I said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not required to do it. I'm not going to do it. People have been doing this for thousands of years. I can't help it if you don't understand it. So, in the end, I had to write a book report. And in order to get these guys off our backs, we had to show them that not everyone who ate marinated cheese was going to die of Clostridium, because there had been a couple reports in the literature where garlic and oil had caused botulism. Okay, but the difference was it wasn't garlic and cheese in oil. And so what we showed them is that there is a thing called water activity, with water being 1.00. And if you reduce the water activity in a food, you lower the ability for pathogens to reproduce. You can also lower the pH. Cheese is about 5 or 5.5. You can have a high salt content. And you can also have other barriers, which are of more interest to me, and those are lactobacilli, which are your common cheese culturing organisms, are really vicious things. They produce components called bacteriocins. And every lactobacilli produces its own. There's lactobacilli reuteri that produces reuterin. There are other lactobacilli that produce nisin, which is a known botulism inhibitor. And we wrote this book report despite the fact that I was very resistant, because the department had tested marinated goat feta, they had tested marinated gouda, they had tested all these marinated cheeses, and they found no salmonella, no listeria, no staph. So here's what we showed them. And of course, this is all out in the literature, it's been known for years, that feta cheese that is soaked in a salt brine has about more than 3% salt content. So that's why nothing's going to happen to feta cheese. Its water activity is about 0.94, 0.95. 1 month old cheese, the salt concentration is in half because you've added oil and you've added other ingredients. But when you get to age cheese, we had some cheese that had been aged for 8 months. We had a high salt content, more than 0.5%. And our water activity had dropped below the limit of concern, which is 0.855. And so after I did my book report, that was the end of that. But sometimes you really have to put this kind of information in front of the regulator. So what we said is that, in common with traditional cheeses of this type, Whitey Grit Farm marinated cheeses pose little risk of botulism to the public because they contain barriers to the growth of botulism and other infectious organisms. I told them what we did. And I said, and therefore, these cheeses do not meet the definition of a potentially hazardous food. And so we put this in their face, and that kind of did it. But sometimes you have to actually write things up like this in order to get them in front of a higher level of regulator or a judge. So as a result of our adventures, we're still providing fluid goat milk, probiotic yogurts, and raw milk cheeses to people in Central Texas and around the country. We have managed to collect most of the world's scientific literature on raw milk and raw milk cheeses, the statistics on raw milk foodborne illnesses, and the critiques of references by the health department, who try to tell you that a goat in Czechoslovakia died of a tick thing, and therefore milk produced in the United States is going to be hazardous. I'd like to close with Dr. Bill German from UC Davis, who contends that the understanding of how a single food can provide nourishment, maturation, and protection will serve as a blueprint for the future of nutritionally improved foods. I thank you very much, and I'm available to take questions if we have a moment. Yes. Yes, sir.
Are there any downsides to drinking raw milk apart from the fact that are there any?
Okay. The gentleman has asked if there are any downsides from drinking raw milk. We are not aware of any from goat milk. There are, again, some single case reports in the literature regarding Salmonella Dublin and drinking cow milk. Generally, any downsides are due to poor sanitation. And with our very sterile foods these days, the one thing that it has been reported, is when people take, let's say, milk with a high bacterial content, their system isn't used to it. And they may end up with what we call self-limiting diarrhea. Okay, so that's...